Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, where I help product managers become product masters. The lean startup approach has brought a lot of visibility to the importance of getting out of your office and interacting with actual customers. I know, novel concept. And you do that so you can understand the details of their problems related to the solution or product you envision as a product manager and innovator. However, the frequent question is, how do we actually get that done? Which leads to other questions like, you know, who do we talk with? What do we ask them? What information is most important? The practical answers to all of these questions is in a framework called Jobs to be Done. And when used properly, it can position product managers to greatly increase the success of the products they develop because the products are solving a real job the customer has in a way that the customer recognizes as being most valuable to them. That's really powerful. To learn about this framework, I went to the source, the person who runs the website, jobstobedone.org, which has a blessing of Clayton Christensen, who originally formulated this framework. This person is Chris Speck. Chris is a software programmer who discovered the Jobs to be Done framework and used it to create successful software products customers really did love. He has also been a founder and co-founded his current company, The Rewired Group, which is a firm based in Michigan that creates improved products and new products for their clients. We talk about a lot of great free resources in the interview, and to get them, go to the show notes at theeverydayinnovator.com/057. Enjoy the interview. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining me and talking about the Jobs to be Done framework.
Hey, Chad. Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you are. Your background is originally in software development. What took you from doing that and getting into product management?
Yeah. So I'm going to say a little bit tongue in cheek, but the reality of it is a lot of pain. So a lot of difficult software projects, a lot of struggling with scope creep, a lot of just hard conversations with clients over the years. So at the time that I was doing software development, I started off as a developer, worked my way up through a little startup to become one of the managers, one of the partners, and took on the job of doing a lot of the sales, scoping a lot of the projects on the way in, and then kind of handing these things off to, you know, project managers and things like that. And what ended up happening was I found myself pretty much playing the role of a product manager for companies who wanted custom software developed that didn't really have in-house product management functions. Hmm. And what that led to was I'd have clients that would get on a track of really just wanting more and more features packed into whatever, you know, software we were developing for them. And I always was trying to make them as successful as I could, you know, while also keeping an eye on budgets and timelines and keeping projects profitable and all that sort of thing. And time and time again, I found myself in situations where I was having, you know, arguments and conducting negotiations with clients, basically saying, I understand what your objective is, and I hear you wanting to add all these features, and I hear you saying things like, you know, if we can't add these things, it's not even worth launching. And well, the competitors just added that, and if we don't have it, we're not even in the game, and things right. like that. And I would always try to push back and say, look, let's stick to the game plan. We knew what we were doing. We were going in. Let's iterate. We'll test, and then we'll make some decisions later. And I kept getting killed in these negotiations, and the scope creep would just get out of control, you know, project after project. And mm-hmm. and what I ended up figuring out was I needed a better way to understand, you know, consumer motivation. So a lot of these projects were things like e-commerce and content management and that sort of thing. And what I decided was, unless I had a really, really good grasp on what the end user or what the consumer was trying to accomplish, I wasn't going to be very good at these negotiations, and I wasn't going to be very good at making my customers successful either. Because even though they were hiring me as kind of the technical software person, they were really they needed a lot of help in the product management, you know, sort of consumer insight space. So I doubled down. I learned as much as I could about things like personas and big data and all that sort of thing to try to get educated. I tried to apply those things with not a whole lot of success. And around that same time, I took on a new client. His name was Bob Mesta, and we ended up doing a lot of projects over the years together. And as it turns out, Bob was one of the creators of this Jobs to be Done framework alongside Clay Christensen. Mm-hmm. And kind of time after time, Bob would come to me with these sort of weird product specs, and I would always say, okay, I can help you think about this and help you kind of shape this up. And he would say, no, like develop this and we'll be fine. And eventually I had to go back to him and say, look, everything you bring to me to develop is a little bit different than everyone else. And it's always kind of like wildly successful. Like what's the trick? What's going on here? How are you kind of arriving at these insights? And we never really used the word jobs to be done at the time. We just talked about customers and talked about how they switched to new products and that sort of thing. But over the years, he ended up teaching me kind of the methods that he would use to arrive at these insights that would lead him to develop successful products and websites and e-commerce stores and things like that. And at that point, I basically decided, if I was gonna be successful, I needed to kind of go deep on this stuff and really, really, really learn it. And so Bob and I ended up starting the Rewired Group in 2008, 2009. I exited the software company and basically said, let's kind of take this to the next level. And at the time, there were some people talking about jobs to be done. It wasn't incredibly mainstream. I'd say it's still not mainstream. But Bob and I sort of with Clay Christensen's blessing, took on the task of, doing whatever we can to teach people about jobs to be done, to kind of refine it as a framework and to kind of push it forward. Does that answer your question?
It does. And I want to go back to how you described the pain of being that software developer.
Yeah.
Because I was trying not to laugh. The laugh was in sympathy because, you know, and I'm sure so many of the everyday innovators that are listening have been in that same spot too, that, you know, we know the craft of developing the product, but we're having frustrations with the clients and trying to actually meet their needs and the other stakeholders involved. And when I was in that position, I went down the path of learning more about project management because that's the first thing I found in the world, right, that might offer some insights. And that helped. And we just stumbled, and there wasn't anything that really led to this. I was just a person that was wired to kind of do user observations. I liked sitting in with customers and watching what they do and kind of informally do ethnographic research. And we were doing agile stuff, you know, in the 90s before people were actually kind of talking about that sort of thing and bringing customers in and co-developing with them, right? And that sort of thing worked quite a bit. But it was only rather recently that I came across some more powerful frameworks like Jobs to be Done. And so I'm glad we're diving into that. And I thought it was interesting on your bio, you say, you develop great products that people want to buy using jobs to be done. And I like that because it creates that curiosity, you know, and I'm sure people go, jobs to be what? So when you get asked that question, what do you tell them that this is about?
Yeah, it does create curiosity. So you said a couple important things. I love the laugh because it's one of those things where you and I can both look back on those times and be like, man, we were really dying back there with those projects.
But that's true.
It's good to be able to look back and laugh at it now. So, the what I always tell people. So people always think it's a task management tool. First off, right? Like things to be done, things to check off. What I always tell people is, it's a way of thinking about why we purchase the things that we purchase in our lives. And so at a very high level, it's simply a way of saying if someone's going to purchase something new that they've never used before, we call it a switch. How do we gain an understanding of why they made that decision? And a lot of times I say we, because when you're learning the framework, it's like we always want to jump to how do I apply it to whatever I'm working on. But oftentimes I push people to say, if I can teach you a couple tools that we use with Jobs to be Done, can you turn it inwards and think about maybe the last few products that you've purchased and really understand how you were motivated and how what the thought process was and how your opinions changed over time as you sort of approach that point in time where you made the decision. It's really useful as you start to learn jobs to be done. But at its core and at a very high level, that's simply all it is how it's a framework for thinking about how we make the decisions that we make.
Right. And I tie it always back to what is the product that what's the real value that the product is offering to customers, right? Yep. And, you know, my simple example is if my job is I have a hole I need dug, right? The product I go buy is a shovel. but I don't buy a shovel just because I'm enamored with the shovel. I'm buying it for a specific job, which is to dig the hole.
That's exactly it. So to go like kind of one level deeper from the general description, what we always say is it's the situation that you're in along with the progress that you're trying to make in your life that defines value. So it's like you say, we often find ourselves in kind of a trap of, you know, I want to look through the product's eyes at the customer. Why would he love the shovel? How could I make him love the shovel more? What if we made it a different color? What if we made it out of a lightweight material? And we think of all these things about the shovel. Jobs to be done prompts us to sort of change the perspective and say, what's going on in his life that he needs the hole in his backyard? And if that's what he's trying to accomplish, and that's the situation that he's in, what constraints is he working with? How is he actually thinking about this kind of project or progress in his life? And how is he defining value and defining progress? And what you – I'm going to just continue with your metaphor because I really, really like it. What you end up figuring out is that the shovel at Home Depot or Lowe's is not competing with all the other shovels on the shelf. The shovel is going to compete with, you know what, I'll get my brother-in-law to come over on Saturday. Maybe he'll bring the shovel with him and we can dig the hole together. Maybe I'll hire a guy on Angie's List and he can come over and dig it. You know, I don't even need to be here. What we find is when we understand the situational, what we call situational context and the progress that we're trying to make, competition changes completely. Mm. And that's really always what we're after is getting the understanding of how the customer defines value and what the product that we're working on really, really competes with in the consumer's mind.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. I've had a similar conversation a few times the last several weeks about so many products are in a commodity market now. And, you know, the typical positioning if you're a salesperson on a high-end product is you talk about how, you know, your features are superior than everyone else's. And in reality, you know, everyone else can add those features and they probably have them, right? And we're moving to a commodity state in a lot of places. But if you instead deeply understand your customer's problem, and you can then frame your solution in terms of how it best meets their problem, you're setting yourself apart from all the other competitors. You're moving out of that commodity space into being a true problem solver. And to me, it seems like the Jobs to Be Done framework gets us there really quickly. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely right. I think it's one of those signals where, like, anytime you're staring at the matrix of features that you've built about your product. And it's like, this is, you know, how many rows can we check versus how many rows can the competition check? I think it's a great time to like kind of lift your head out of that and say, how do we talk to a couple customers to really figure out what's going on and what's causing them to even like start shopping for what we're offering. And one of the kind of biggest, I guess eye openers that happened for me is just how few things consumers hold in their mind when they make a decision, especially when it gets to these like really, really complex purchases. As the product developer, we always want to think like, man, they're doing really diligent research and they're comparing us head to head. And man, we added these couple features and we're just going to knock the socks off the competition. When you talk to the customer, it's like they're thinking of their lives and their needs and like at most one, two, you know, three aspects of your product, and they've linked those things together and they're ready to make a decision and move forward. But the idea that they're people just are holding all these comparisons in their mind and all these different features, I've worked kind of from the simplest, you know, $1 consumer packaged goods kind of food products all the way up to the most complicated enterprise software sort of, you know, corporate sales. And it's all the same. It's just like people make a decision. They have one or two things in their mind and they run with it. So I think what you've highlighted on the kind of, you know, commodity head-to-head competition space is really important.
And I think the other aspect of that is as product managers, we often get it wrong, right? There's a great connection. I've been paying a little bit more attention to comedians in the last year and their craft. And comedians talk about, you know, the killer joke, you know, stand-up comedians, the killer joke that I expected to just win the audience over, you know, landed flat. And as a comedians, they go out and they test their material all the time in small venues before they take it to the big stage, right?
Yeah.
Because it's hard for them to actually know what's going to work and what's not. And I think as product managers, you know, maybe on a good day, we get 50% of it right in terms of what really understanding what the customer's problem is, what the key points are they're thinking about, how they think about value and those things. And so we need to be talking to them. So we probably should talk about how this actually gets done then. How do we identify the job and how do we go through that discovery process? Can you walk us through an example of actually using the Jobs to Be Done framework?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my, I guess one of my favorite stories is what we think of as kind of a classic in the Jobs to Be Done world is one of the first applications was for the Snickers bar. Hmm. And so I get an interesting reaction when I tell the story, because I think a lot of people want, we've done work with great companies like Basecamp and like great tech companies, and a lot of people want to hear those stories. But I often find it's great to tell a story that kind of that hits everyone. Like most of us have had a Snickers bar, right? So a lot of times, you can relate to something like this. So back, this is like early 90s, the Snickers bar was head to head with Milky Way, another Mars product. Mm-hmm. And they were in a situation at the time where one of these products was going to be delisted. And essentially, anyone who's worked in CPG knows the retailers have control of a lot of this or influence over a lot of this. If you have two products that are very similar and mm-hmm. and they're turning at about the same rate, a lot of times the retailer is going to come to you and say, find something else to put up there and let's see if we can get it to turn faster, right? Because these things are very, very similar.
Right.
When you look at Snickers and Milky Way, same form factor, same size, label is almost identical, right? A little bit of green in one, a little bit of blue and red in the other. Same size, almost looks identical on the shelf. And this was the situation that Mars was in. And at the time, Bob actually, my partner Bob Mesta, actually had a friend who was working on the Snickers team at Mars, called Bob out and basically as a consultant said, hey, this is the situation we're in. We're on the Snickers team and we need to beat up on Milky Way or we're going to be delisted. And Bob had that head scratching moment of like, all right, you guys are in the same company. Like, this is really how things work. And the guy said, yeah, we got to make this thing fly. So Bob got, all of the downloads of the advertising at the time, how these things are manufactured on the line, incredibly simple. Snickers at the time still had peanuts. Milky Way was still mostly nougat. But when you looked at kind of cross sections of them, these things were very, very similar, like ran kind of like next to each other on almost identical lines in the factory. Hmm. Very, very similar. And so Bob took in all the data, looked at all the sales reports, did all that sort of thing, and basically said, I have no idea how these things differentiate from one another. I don't know how to, how to help Snickers. And so he had flown to New Jersey where Mars was at the time. And his friend said, fly home for the weekend. If anything comes to you, let me know. If not, it's been fun catching up. So Bob went to the airport, was walking into kind of the newspaper stand to grab something. And the guy in front of him bought a Snickers bar. And so Bob grabbed whatever he was buying from the newspaper stand, followed this guy to his gate, sat down kind of one seat away and said, hey, I just got to ask. I don't mean to interrupt. Like, what's going on? I saw you bought a Snickers bar. Can you tell me what's happening? And then the guy told the story of, I've been here all week. It's Friday. I'm flying home. I've got a heap of work to get done, here at the gate and then on the plane. If I don't get it done, I've got to work over the weekend. I can't spend time with my family. And the situation is really, I wanted to go to the restaurant in the terminal and grab a sandwich and a beer, to kind of fuel myself up. But I don't have the time. And when I walked in the newspaper stand, like the thing that I saw was a Snickers. It's got a little bit of peanut in it. Like I think it's, my energy is kind of falling through the floor. I think it's going to give me just enough of a pep to kind of get my work done. Hmm. And as Bob talked, so this is the infancy of Jobs to Be Done, right? Because he didn't know any demographic information about this guy, his age, his financial status, anything like that. It's simply someone in a situation trying to get something done who had picked this product to do it and who had some constraints around him, right? So Bob went back to the newspaper stand time and time again, saw people buy Snickers and eventually ended up talking to the guy that ran the newspaper stand. He said, yeah, I sold a lot of Snickers bars. I couldn't tell you why. I don't sell a lot of Milky Way, but that's the way things are. And so Bob gets home, eventually finds some people who had eaten Milky Ways recently, and these people all told a very different story than the Snickers bar stories. And the story around the Milky Way was something happened. I need a little bit of time for me, and I like when that happens, if I can't have a glass of wine, you know, I'm at work, I'm sitting in my office, I can't grab the Ben and Jerry's pint and kind of go through that whole thing. I can't have a slice of cake. This is like my little indulgence. And it's like, it's a 5 minute, 7 minute sort of break in the day where I can regroup. It's usually coming from someplace negative, like bring me back to zero or bring me a little bit positive, but it's all me time. And this was like, this was the understanding of, okay, we have products that are very similar, look exactly the same on the shelf, almost identical ingredients that never compete with each other. And it was the first instance where we say, okay, so the way that it played out was they reordered some of the layers of ingredients. They turned Snickers into something that has more peanuts. And actually now when you bite into a Snickers bar, you can tell it breaks off in your mouth. You chew it like it's food. It actually hits your stomach like it's food. And it gives you that sensation that you've eaten something. If you contrast it with a Milky Way, it melts in your mouth. You actually, next time you eat one, you'll kind of feel this. You actually kind of drink the Milky Way after you've chewed it for a little bit because it liquefies. It has that coating effect in your mouth. So they steered steered Snickers to be more food-like. They changed the advertising to be Snickers satisfies, and now these most recent ads, which is you're not you when you're hungry, and turn Snickers into the highest selling candy bar of all time, but it's back to the shovel story that you're talking about. Is they all look the same on the shelf, or we're trying to differentiate themselves on the shelf. But when it comes back to the user or to the consumer, if we can understand where they are and really what they're trying to get done, we can match the product to their sense of progress, and you know, sometimes really knock it out of the park. And I guess the one thing that I want to kind of highlight about the method is we talk to people who have made a purchase. And for a lot of people who are listening to this that have projects that they're working on, that'll be easy, right? Because you'll say, oh, I'm running a SaaS product. I want to talk to people who have signed up over the last, you know, 6 months and get the story of them coming in. For other people, they'll be working on what they think is a new product. And then you have to find, you know, sort of ancillary things. Imagine what you're competing with and start to do interviews around that. Mm-hmm. But the important aspect is, I have to have somebody who has made a decision, because I want to understand when did you start thinking about this? Like, you know, I want the car ride to the airport where he's thinking, man, I really need to get this work done because I really miss my family. And if I have to be locked up in my office all weekend, it's not going to have, okay, the restaurant's out. Like, I want to know how they shape what we call shape up the job and create a list of requirements on. Because it's that list of requirements going into the decision that really fuels all this, you know, all this great insight.
And then talking to people who have actually made that decision, a purchasing decision, I have two questions that come to my mind. One is, are you talking to people that made a decision, like in the Snickers example, of product you're thinking about, you know, trying to advance in some way and improve in the marketplace? Or are you also talking to people who bought the competitors' products and finding out why they did that?
Yeah. I always recommend both. So what this really ends up boiling down to usually is just the amount of work that you're willing to take on. So what we usually advocate is, for any situation, if you talk to 10, if you scope the project correctly and you talk to 10 consumers, you're nine, you know, like 99 times out of 10, you're going to get the jobs and understand what's going on in the space. So if you have competitors, if you have people that you can identify that are firing, you know, quote unquote, firing your product, which in the case of Snickers would be like, you used to eat a lot of Snickers bars. You had kind of a habit. Now you stopped eating Snickers bars. Like, the job probably didn't go away, but what did you switch to? I'd almost want to say, like, let's talk to 10 of each of those people. Let's talk to 10 people that hired us, you know, find out what was going on there. 10 people that quote unquote fired us. And then let's get some people who are maybe leaving us and going to competition or even never used our product but are hiring the competition to kind of understand what the differences are.
Okay. And in doing that, do you find that there are segments then among those people you talk to? And what I'm thinking about is I would expect to uncover some people that were in a very they would answer your questions kind of in a cluster, right? Different than everyone else. And so that they're thinking about that the problem they actually have differently, and they would be a different segment to address in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. So what we look for are situational similarities. So what the segments that come out of a jobs to be done study, we actually call jobs. So we'll if we talk to 10 people, we'll normally get 3, 4, 5 jobs out of that that research. And what we'll find is that out of 10, 3 or 4 people will have 2, 3, 4 people will have situations that are all very similar. So they what we want to find is where do the situations kind of overlap at a meaningful level, and then kind of define that as a job. So they all started in sort of a similar place. They all struggled with the same sort of information, and they all had a similar sort of progress that they were trying to make. And usually with any product, we'll find it's being hired for a number of different jobs or different types of progress. Does that make sense?
Does. And then just to connect the dots, the Sinker examples really illustrates as well that you conduct the interviews to really understand the job, the reason why the people bought the product in the first place, or maybe bought the competitor's product. And then you took that information to impact the design of the product. In the case of the Snickers, you know, maybe more peanuts and how the food, the candy, I'm not sure what the nuggets, the stuff inside the Snickers really is, although I do eat them. Yeah. You know, but you reformulated that product to better deliver on the job people were expecting.
Exactly.
Right? And so this is really a pre-design process, right?
The way that we think about it is I almost think of these people as like the consumers are the innovators. Like we've birthed the product and put it out into the market, and these people have figured out how to take what we've created, pull it into their lives, and further their own lives, right? And what I want to understand is if the guy at the airport was doing that, we might not have had that intent going in when we were developing the product, but now that I know that. How do I size that opportunity, and how do I say, okay, if this is what it's being used for, you know, now I know who my competition is. It's obviously not Milky Way. I'm competing with a sandwich, a Coke, a power bar, a Red Bull. It wasn't Red Bull at the time, but it is now. Mm-hmm. How do I craft the product so I can take share away from those guys and be hired more in this situation? And like you said, it gets back into, you know, it's product design, right? What's the right level of peanut? What's the right melting point of the nougat so that it stays food-like, but it's not too hard to bite through? It's all those sorts of things where once I understand the situation that they're in, how do I design the outcome that they want? Because once again, when it gets to food, it's like, it's got to hit the stomach, right? It's got to send the signal to the brain to say, yeah, you're geared up. You've got the fuel. You're not starving. You can do your work. And once you understand that, you can start prototyping and testing. I always get back to, like, I don't know how to design and I don't know how to prototype and test unless I have the situation. Because when you Right. when you peel away the situational context and when you peel away the progress, what you end up with is, like, which one do you like? So you get the people and it's like, try the Snickers bar and try the Milky Way. And they'll say, oh, I like the Milky Way a lot better than the Snickers. Okay, well, why? Well, it's softer and it seems a little bit sweeter. And then the next person will tell you they like Snickers. But the problem is it's completely void of context. So as I test and as I prototype, I can change levels and I can do all these things, but I don't know what the desired outcome is. I don't know what they're trying to do. So it's like it becomes kind of circular and scary.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, from a software development perspective, which I know a little bit about, but not as much as you for sure, it's like walking into a room that's just completely blank and you know you're supposed to develop features, right? And I think that's where most software developers are today versus having a tool like this with jobs to be done where you're walking in the room and there's all this scaffolding in place, right? That's already there to help inform your design and what the features need to be. Because now you understand the context of what the customer's actually need, what the customer actually needs to accomplish.
Absolutely, that's very well said.
I'm not sure if it was a great metaphor, but the scaffolding notion came to mind, so I was running with it. So,
yeah, no, I really like it.
So, as you talk about Snickers, this made me think about a Clay Christensen video. Have you seen him talk about the milkshake?
Yeah, they call Bob the milkshake man. So absolutely, I've seen it.
That's great. And so what we're talking about is he did a study. I think it was for Burger King, actually. Does that sound right?
McDonald's.
Was it McDonald's? Okay. Fast food restaurant. And they wanted to find out why they were selling milkshakes in the morning and what was going on. They actually interviewed people as they went through the drive-through after they bought their milkshake about what they did and what job they were trying to satisfy. And we won't go into the details because it matches the Snickers example really well. But in the show notes, if you want to see that, I'll put a link in there. And the show notes will be theeverydayinnovator.com/057. And you'll find a link to Christensen talking about the job to be done for the milkshake. So in this framework, we have other tools. One of them is called the Four Forces. Can you walk us through what that tool is and why it's important?
Yeah, so the Four Forces essentially describes, we think about it as a consumer is trying to make progress in their lives, we say that, running in place is making no progress, right? I'm just going to continue to do what I'm doing right now. It's on the left side of the diagram. If you cross the diagram and go to the right, you have new behavior. I've bought something that I've never purchased before. I've tried something new, right? So we always study the forces that are acting on consumers as they cross over. And what we find is that there's always something going on in your life that you're struggling with. We call that the push. So it's completely void of a solution or void of a product, but it's something. It's like, you know, that hole in the backyard has got to get dug, right? I don't know how I'm going to do it. I don't know what's going to happen to make that happen, but at some point that's going to have to happen. And then if you move to the right, we have what we call pull or magnetism of the solution. So you have somebody that's trying to make progress and you add to that a product like a shovel. And that shovel will draw the customer towards it with things like price and features and promises of what it can deliver, all that sort of thing. So now we have two forces acting on a consumer that should propel them forward. And to add to that, we have two forces that act against the consumer. So one is what we call anxiety, which is, you know, can I operate the shovel? Are the promises that the shovel is making, you know, are they viable, right? They're saying that it's strong. They're saying that it can dig the hole. You know, will it deliver on these promises? What if the shovel doesn't work? Can I return it? All these anxieties that bubble up. Mm-hmm. And then the last one that acts against the consumer is the habit of the present. Maybe the hole doesn't really need to get dug. I've lived without a hole for a long time. I can put it off till later. There's always this habit, right? And what I always tell people is, the one thing is we always focus as product developers on the top portion of the diagram, which is the push and the pull. What we feel is if I can outshine my competition, I can add features, I can increase that pull force,
right,
I'll get everyone to switch to my product. And what experience has taught us is that like success as a product manager and a product developer lives on the bottom, because every feature that we add creates anxiety. It's another thing to make the consumer say, I don't know if I know how to work that feature. I don't know if they're going to deliver on that. It's just more kind of gunk in the system. If you can find a way to relieve the anxiety, to understand the story of the person trying to make the decision and say, here's how you're thinking about it. Here's what you're anxious about. We're going to be there to take that anxiety away. It's where all the money is made, in my opinion. So, when it comes down to the usefulness of the tool, I think it's a good mechanism to have a conversation about a person's story. You know, what was the push? What was pushing them to make progress? Why not just keep, you know, why not just keep the backyard the way it is? Why dig the hole? What was kind of pulling them towards the new solution? You know, mm-hmm. What was the magnetism that they latched onto? And then, you know, what were they anxious about? What do we need to unhinge in them to help them, you know, make this progress?
You know, as you talk through that, the notion of the minimal viable product MVP and lean methodologies really came to mind. And the way that we got connected was through Ash Mariah, who wrote the Running Lean book. And I was paying attention to what he was doing. And then he mentioned that he was investigating the jobs to be done framework, right? How that kind of ties into things. And this is why I think this framework is so very important for the listeners. And I hope everyone dives into this a little bit more and learns about it. is because now the conversation has moved, you know, across companies, whether you're a startup or established enterprise, to how do we find out information about our customers earlier before we actually start developing products, right? What are our assumptions? What are those hypotheses? How do we test those and get information, right? Kind of the standard lean startup, running lean sort of approach. The Jobs to Be Done framework fits so well into that as a framework for thinking about what questions do you need to ask, who do you ask them to, and how do you get down the road on really understanding, I'll go back to my scaffolding method metaphor again, you know, the scaffolding, the framework that you need to understand so you can design a product that actually solves their problem. And can you just comment on that? I'm sure you've seen these intersections and people that are looking into lean startup type philosophies and then come across Jobs to Be Done.
Yeah, I think so. I think you described a lot of it really well. Ash and I connected. It had to be a little bit over a year ago, and it played out sort of exactly how you described. So we do a 1 day workshop on Jobs to Be Done, where we do have a couple live interviews. We talk through the tools, and the intent is that you leave that day being able to go apply it to your product, right? At the same time, Ash was doing his running lean workshops, kind of walking step by step through how to create the MVP, how to run all the tests, and he has kind of the roadmap for the startup, right? Mm-hmm. And we ended up kind of coming together. We've only done one. I'm sure we're kind of talking about doing the next one, but we did a workshop that was 2 days, 1 day of running lean and the next day of Jobs to Be Done, and what we found was like, the people have the step by step sort of instructions on how to create the MVP and go through the lean process, and within that there is a bullet point that says get out of the office, go talk to the customers, right? And I see Jobs to Be Done almost as that bullet point.
Exactly. And I think that's such the important, right? This is the big hole that needs to be filled, because everyone running into lean sort of approaches is going, okay, I know I need to do that. What questions do I actually ask? Who do I ask them to? What is it I'm trying to find out?
Yep. Absolutely. And I think there are, Jobs to Be Done is one method. I think there are a lot of methods, out there that kind of, like you alluded to before, ethnographic research and things like that. I think Jobs is very well suited for that lean methodology. Just get as close to that customer as you possibly can.
Right. And I like the picture that you put together for the Four Forces tool, that we're trying to create satisfaction for the customer, solve their problem, and at the same time, reduce anxiety. And as product managers, hopefully we're figuring this out, that adding complexity to our products complicates our lives, complicates our organization's life, and does not help the customer. We want to remove anxiety and just solve the problem that they're after finding a solution to.
Absolutely.
This is very good. For the four forces, you described that as a diagram. Do you have a diagram I could add to the show notes so listeners can see what that looks like?
Absolutely. It's very hard. So it's hard to do on the podcast because I'm kind of drawing in midair, but we'll put the image up there and they can pull it up.
Yeah, that would be great. If you have a link, you can give me, I'll put it in. So listeners, you can go back to the show notes, again, the Everyday Innovator /057, everydayinnovator.com/057. And we'll have that there for you. Make it easy. Okay. And I asked you to bring an innovation quote to share with us. What did you put together?
So Bob Mesta, this is a couple years ago, came up with this, and he said this kind of in passing, and it's kind of stuck. And what he said was, the struggling moment is the seed of innovation. And I think it's definitely my favorite innovation quote. I think it's very controversial. So I think within product development, there are, people or ideas around, we just need to come up with the next big thing. We just need to dazzle them with, technological breakthroughs and efficiencies and things like that. And what Bob is really saying is, if we can understand where people are struggling, what they're trying to get done, and understand those situations, that really creates opportunities for innovation. And it's not guessing what the consumer wants. It's really studying, what are they trying to accomplish? What are they using now to accomplish that? And where are they still struggling? Where is there that opportunity where, if we were to give them the ability to do things cheaper, faster, better, there's that built up struggle in the consumer that will just be unleashed or resolved. So it's by far one of my favorite quotes.
Yeah, I love that. As I've often said, listeners have heard of me, we certainly developing the product is challenging, but in general, we have pretty good processes for that. We can figure out how to get most things developed. Not that it's easy, but we can get through that. But it's coming up with the right idea that actually solves a real problem, that creates value, and does so in a way that beats the competitor solutions, that makes all the difference. And I like how that struggling moment captures that aspect of innovation, that's where we really need to start. So thanks for sharing Bob's quote and telling us about it.
Absolutely. And I completely agree. Like, I think there is more, like, we have more technical capability than we'll ever be capitalized on, right? It's really matching what we can build to what people are trying to get done. That's for me, that's the crux of the issue.
Yeah. Our big issue, you know, and this is where Lean Startup came from, right? Eric's experience of developing a product that got launched and all we heard were crickets, right? That no one purchased the product. And every company has been there, and the industry stats on this are not good, right? So some are on the order of about 1 in 10 market launches actually becomes a success. And the issue is we need to solve real problems in a way that provide real value. And that's just where we are. And I think this Jobs to Be Done framework offers so much concrete steps to helping us move in the right direction. How can listeners find out more about applying Jobs to Be Done and the work that you're doing?
Yeah, so we run a website called jobstobedone.org. And that should act as kind of like the home base. So in there we have a podcast. You can also find the podcast on iTunes, but it's on jobstobedone.org. We have an online course. If you go to jobstobedone.org, you can click the learn button, and we'll have information about upcoming face-to-face workshops, as well as the online course that that they can take. I highly recommend starting by studying some of the interviews, and it's almost like you don't want to listen so much to the actual like technique. You want to think about, why are we asking the questions that we're asking? We tend to not ask a whole lot of product questions. We ask a lot of questions about the story leading up to the purchase, because that's really what we're all about, understanding what was going on in the person's life before they made that purchase. So within our podcast, we have a couple of live interviews. One of them is about a person buying a mattress. I highly recommend that. Also, Bob did an interview with Horace Dedu, who from Critical Path, about a car that Horace purchased. We'll put the link in the show notes for that as well. But that's gotten a lot of great reviews, and he really gets into the motivational, you know, gets into Horace's struggle. So I'll recommend that as well.
Excellent. And those are wonderful resources, because Everyday Innovators, I'm sure you're thinking about, well, how do I actually construct the interview then to get this information? And being able to hear those in the podcast and how that was done is really valuable. So I appreciate you sharing those free resources with us, and I will make sure they get into the show notes.
Absolutely. So the last thing I'll add is we can figure out technically how to do this, but I'll share my email address if you want to put that into the show notes. Okay. Any questions that your listeners have about, this is the product I'm working on, how would I create, you know, how would I put together the project? Who should I talk to? That sort of thing. I do this all day long, so I'm happy to answer any questions, or, you know, jump on the phone for a half an hour and kind of talk through what they're working on. Just more than happy to offer that up.
Okay. And Chris, what's easier for you? You know, sometimes publishing email publicly can lead to some problems. Certainly glad to do it if you want. Or would you rather people connect with you through your LinkedIn profile?
Yeah, LinkedIn is, so we can do the LinkedIn, and I'm also pretty active on Twitter. I'm Chris CBS, Charlie Bravo Sam on Twitter as well.
Excellent. Good. So if you want to follow up with Chris specifically with any questions, the show notes will have his LinkedIn profile and that Twitter handle too. Chris, I so much appreciate you sharing the information about Jobs to Be Done framework and providing those links to the resources for us. And listeners, you can find all those details at the show notes. Chris, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening. The best gift you can give me is telling other product managers and innovators about this podcast. It always means the world to me when you do, and I really appreciate you doing that. And you'll find all the notes from this discussion with Chris, including the links to several valuable resources at theeverydayinnovator.com/057. Please check it out. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.